Okay, welcome to this next lecture on the translation of Prolog. We identified the key operation in when executing or when realizing the semantics of a Prolog program, and that was unification. So that was the basic computation step. So, and for that we provided a machine instruction, unify, which takes two references to terms, two addresses of terms on the stack, unifies them by introducing bindings or triggering backtracking, and then pops off the two references. So this kind of formalizes and realizes the intuition that unification has does not have a return value, but kind of has its effect by means of a side effect. So it's, the whole effect of unify is a side effect, namely introducing the bindings. So that means, therefore, no value is returned on the stack. So the stack does not receive anything from the unify. Now, how would unify work? Last time we tried already to kind of capture the what that function should do. For that, we first kind of established kind of a precondition under which this function, a simplifying precondition under which this function only is applied, namely that the two references on top of the stack should be maximally dereferenced, so that we kind of know when there is when the address of the heap cell at a given address is an R value, R object, then we know it is an unbound variable because we have kind of maximally dereferenced. Okay, then just as a recap, so the next thing is we want to unify. So if the two things are already identical, identified by two identical addresses, then we say, okay, that's fine. These two things are, nothing must be done. Now, if there are two variables which are to be unified, then two unbound variables, we have two possibilities, either binding the one to the other or the other to the one. And so the general strategy is to have these references always pointing from higher addresses to lower addresses. Therefore, we bind the younger variables to the older one. So that's one thing. And then if we have an ordinary binding where an unbound variable is bound to a term, no matter whether it is at a higher or a lower address, we kind of have to check to make sure that this variable does not occur inside the term. And since a variable kind of is a heap object, we kind of have to traverse this term and see whether this there's a reference to this same heap object. So this is the occur check, which we will have to implement in a minute. For the moment, this is kind of an auxiliary function, which is called by the unify thing. And the other thing is, whenever we introduce a binding, we have to keep track of it, because it may be that this unification was later turns out to be a dead end, and we will have to undo the bindings. So therefore, we have to record the bindings. And finally, if the if unification fails, then we have to not only to fail silently, but kind of throw an exception to trigger backtracking. And this we will do not by throwing an exception, but we have our runtime system, so therefore we will have a particular auxiliary function which kind of brings the virtual machine into a state that backtracking will be executed. So, and now I have described it, and after having so that you do not get the impression that we do here infinite postponement, we, after a three-stage postponement, you finally see the unify. And one must say here, this is kind of It is debatable whether one should implement Unify in this way, because maybe you have learned, in whoever has been explained unification so far. Have you ever learned about it in any lecture you had? Unification of terms as a basic operation. So this is a standard problem. So now, just let me do one more little postponement. So you have a term like, for example, not in this low-level implementation, but in any implementation, you have kind of a term fxa, and you want to unify it with a term fb, y. Yeah? So this is a classical. So these solving such equations, so finding values for x and y, so that this is this equation is satisfied, this is unification. And it is a standard problem in theorem proving, artificial intelligence, and whatnot where. And so people have come up to try to find efficient algorithms for it. And there are kind of linear algorithms even, which is a little bit, which is critical in that sense, as the resulting terms, which you can just doing this unification, it might be that the terms you have to construct to make the two terms equal can be exponentially large, exponential in the number of occurring variables. So therefore, these polynomial time algorithms kind of work on a graph-based compressed representation of terms. So that one can do. And this unification algorithm, which I show you here, is not of that kind. It's much simpler. It is in the worst case, and that is when the resulting terms are exponential, then this algorithm will be exponential. So in that sense, we should be... But the point is that this algorithm is so simple, easy to implement, that we can put it at the heart of our virtual machine. While the other ones need auxiliary data structures and give the bindings in an implicit, the solution in an implicit way, which is all not what we need, because we want to have kind of the representation of terms, and we have this particular realization of these variables by means of this R object in the heap. And so we are happy to have the most simple unification algorithm which you could imagine. So this kind of put aside. So the message here is unification is a standard algorithm, is a standard algorithmic problem, which is interesting on its own, and there are interesting and non-trivial algorithms to deal with it. But here we will not deal with it. We only consider the most simple thing, which is actually that what people really do here, and here it is. So we want to unify the two terms, so we start at the roots. We compare the roots, see if and see what we can do, and if we kind of are done with the root, we will proceed to the successors. And if the terms are structurally similar, then there is the same list of they have this the root has the same label, and we have subtrees which we kind of two lists of subtrees which are of the same length, and which we kind of proceed process one after the other. So that's the whole thing. And here is the little implementation of it. So we first start with checking the two references, whether they are equal. So this is our nice optimization. If yes, then they are true. It's true, and we kind of are done. If the first address points to a R object, an indirection, then... Okay, so this since everything is maximally dereferenced, we know this is an unbound variable. So if the other one also is such an unbound variable, then we do this. We may do this binding of one of the unbound variables to the other, and here we kind of insist that it is the higher one which we bind to the lower one. Yeah, and here is this fabulous trail, in order to keep track of what we are doing. And so returning true always means Unify has succeeded. Okay? So this is, note that this kind of Unify function, so it returns a value, once we are done with it, then okay. So, and here the kind of here is for the other case when the other variable is bound, and here you see we call trail. Also, so now otherwise, so this now we come to the case here. This is the case where one is a variable, an unbound variable, while the other is not. So here in this case, U is an unbound variable, while V is not. So then we have to do this checking, the occur check, for U and V. And this, you see here the convention is that U is a reference, is the address of an unbound variable, and V is a maximally dereferenced something, and it points to a constructed term. Yeah? So that is the invariant, the calling convention, if you like, for the auxiliary function check, which performs the occur check. And you see, if the occur check says yes, so that does not mean that U occurs there, but it means that U does not occur there, because everything is fine. So checking means here it is fine. Yeah? And fine means X does not occur in the term. Yeah? This is check. And then if this is, so everything is fine, then we can do the binding. So here is the binding. We introduce the binding of the U. The variable now is bound, so it's a reference now to the other, to the constructed term. And we trail U because U has been bound. Okay, everything is fine. Now, otherwise, here in this, I make it black, in this particular situation, the check did not succeed. So this means the variable pointed, identified by the address U, occurs inside V. This is now alarm. So unification definitely fails, and we do the backtracking. And also, in order to kind of to kind of propagate this information that it failed, we here return for this recursive call of unify false. Because we do not, if we had an if backtrack were an exception, then this instance of the unify function could be blown off. But backtrack is not an exception, it's just an ordinary function, so it does a little bit something, and we additionally return the false, kind of to propagate outside that unification has failed. And we do not have to do any more checks. Okay. So that was the case where U was a variable. Now comes the symmetric case when V is a variable, an unbound variable. So this is this situation. So let me make it yellow again. And here again, since we have checked already the situation where both are variables, we now are sure that the U points to a constructed term. And then again, we have to do the occur check, which is here. And if this is fine, so then we can do the binding and do the trailing and return true. If it's not fine, so that means the check fails, that is, now V occurs inside U. And then we have to do our black thing, so now the Black Friday, a backtracking and false. Okay, so that is the case where a variable is involved. Now comes the simple cases, when there's no variable involved. If there's no variable, we only compare constructors. So we, for example, if U is an atom, then V also must be an atom and exactly the same atom, and then we are fine. Or U must be a constructor with name F and arity N, and then V also must be a similar constructor. And if so, we kind of have to proceed recursively with the successors of the two nodes U and V. And the successors have addresses U plus 1 up to U plus N, because the constructors have the same arity N. So this is this for loop here. From I equals 1 to I equals N. And for that, we do the unification. And now the children of these of U and V might again be in directions. So we have to do the deref before we call the unify again. So here we do the unification for the unification for the dereferenced successor ith successor, and if this dereference, if this unify returns false, so then we know backtracking has been occurred in this I, and we kind of directly know unification will fail, and therefore we return false and do nothing anymore. Yeah, that means as soon as the first child for the first child's unification fails, then we return false and do no longer consider the second, third, and fourth children. Okay? Otherwise, if so, there's no false, then we kind of process I equals 1 to I equals n and ultimately return true. And everything is fine. Okay? So if this these two green if these green cases do not kind of match, then we arrive at that situation, and that situation is when the constructors do not match, and in this case we backtrack. Yeah, because then unification fails and return false. Okay, so you see, it's not no miracle. It's just the straightforward implementation of kind of comparing the two terms, and when you hit a variable in one and a non-variable in the other, then you do the binding. That's it. And if you have two variables, you do also the binding. And if you have a mismatch, then you give up. Okay. So here is the way how the unification works for an example. So we have, we assume that we have on the stack two references, so these two things, and we call unify with that. And that means we kind of unify these two structs. I marked it in green. I hope you see it. Okay, so these two constructors are the same, have the same name, same arity. So we proceed with the successively with the children. So first with the first children. So the first children is this atom A here, and here we have to do the deref, and then we arrive here at this unbound variable. Okay, so then we have to call unify for this for the A and the unbound variable, and this means we have to introduce the binding, trail the binding, and then additionally kind of continue with the second children, which are two unbound variables, and there we do the binding. And we bind the higher, the younger variable to the older variable. Okay. So.
In the second truck, there is a second unbound variable.
What?
In the second truck, F two, there is a second unbound variable.
Yes. Fine. That's it. It is unbound before and afterwards. It stays unbound. Okay. Not everything must be bound. Borlaug computes with unbound variables. It does the minimal amount of binding. Not the maximal amount, but the minimal. Okay. So here we still have a little, a certain amount of placeholders, which we will have to fill in later. So in this sense, I have done, I kind of resolved a little bit of this postponement, but I still have a postponement. The first thing is the trail. I just list here what we kind of have to, where the holes are. Then there is this backtracking. And there is this checking. I try to explain, but we have not yet looked. We have to provide these runtime functions as well. So perhaps we start with this checking. So checking, this runtime function assumes that the first one is a maximal an unbound variable, and the second one is a term. And so then we have to check whether when we traverse the term, u will occur somewhere in one of the R objects. It's the address of one of the R objects inside the V. And, this is an expensive thing, because in some sense you have to do that all the time. And this, so you do not only have to traverse the two kind of arguments and then do the binding, but before you do the binding, you have to traverse the whole term. And then, okay, it doesn't occur, you do the binding. Then you go one step further, and again you have to traverse the whole term. And then you do the binding. So for every variable you bind, you have to inspect an additional, you have to do an additional traversal of a possibly large tree. So if they are small, these trees, then who cares? But these trees can be large. This can be a full data structure which you have to traverse. And so this could be thousands of nodes, which you just, when you want to bind the variable, you have to look at them. So this is extremely expensive, and therefore compilers or programmers are a little bit reluctant to use this recur check. So sometimes, so therefore many compilers or several compilers offer a possibility to switch this check off. So you do not check. If you call unify of x and f of x, then this will succeed. Now, what is the solution of that? No. This is an infinite tree. So the solution is an infinite tree. X should be f of, so in the infinite, the two things are equal. So clearly, technically, you cannot produce infinite trees, but you can kind of conceptually think of infinite trees, and you can represent it by something like f by such a cyclic structure. And if you have such kind of cyclic trees, cyclic structures or so, or infinite trees, then you can, then it's the, this is semantically the same as if you switch off the occur check. You cannot compute it, but you have an internal representation of it, and then you use it. You cannot print it. And if you print it, then you have no occur check, then either printing will not terminate, or the printer is smart and identifies that there's a back edge and then introduces dot, dot, dot.
So when printing, I have to check the occur.
So that is it depends on what your printer does. Yes, otherwise it's non-terminating. Non-terminating is not always from hell. Sometimes it's a desirable property. And you can always press the control C.
But I don't know when I have to.
Sure, that's it. That's the problem with non-termination. So this is the way how you can kind of deal with the occur check, but kind of ignore it. And this is, from a practical point of view, people sometimes prefer to have a fast implementation which possibly is non-terminating, opposed to a slow implementation which is definitely terminating. So in that sense, you see, if your implementation is sufficiently slow, it is indistinguishable from non-termination anyway. So in that sense, so these two kind of alternatives are not so clear from a practical point of view. From a theoretical and conceptual point of view, you should not switch. You should never switch off the occur check. Okay, so therefore we might provide an implementation. So here is an implementation. So the implementation of the occur check is not so difficult, because you keep the u, this is the variable, and traverse the v and check whether the variables you encounter are equal to u, that's all. So you check, the first thing is you may check whether v is equal to u, and that is, since v initially is an unbound and a maximally dereferenced it points to a struct or an atom. So this initially will always be not equal. So if it were equal, that means that in between you have traversed to you have arrived at a node where they are equal, and then you kind of have to might return false. So that means false. That is the danger. False means danger. Okay. So then now otherwise, if they are not equal, you might kind of check. Perhaps should kind of find a more friendly color. You might check whether the current address is what it is. So if it is a struct, then you have to proceed. If it's an atom, you are done, because then the variable doesn't occur. Definitely doesn't occur. So if it's a struct, you have to successively inspect the successors. So if the struct has arity n, you have to look at n successors, and then you do it in such a way that you kind of always, again, the second argument, the first one is always the u, so that is kind of the same for the check, and the second one is always you maximally dereference, so that you know it's either an unbound variable, an atom, or a struct. So, and therefore you recursively call that. And if the check failed for a successor, for one successor, then you have not, it's not necessary anymore to check the other successors. You immediately propagate the false. So therefore, here we propagate the false. And if that is for the recursion, and if now the final thing which you might arrive at is at a leaf in the tree, where a leaf is an unbound variable which is different from you, or an unbound or an atom. In both cases, we are done. So, and we are done with true, because checking succeeds. Occurred no, the variable u did not occur in v. That's it. Okay, so that's for the occur check. You see, it's simple enough. You only traverse the tree, but it's expensive, as you have to do it all the time for virtually every subtree, and that's kind of this is a nuisance, and therefore people try. That is the reason why people are not happy with this checking, and this is perhaps also one of the reasons why Prolog is so slow. So we will find when you try to do practical programming with Prolog, and use data structures. So there are some weird people use Prolog and use virtually no data structures. Okay. So now that is kind of, by that we did up to backtracking and trailing. We are done with unification. At least we could say so. Yeah, because this translation of this unification was a simple thing. We simply delegated everything to the runtime function, and but it is not so. It's not so nice, because recall what we did. For the t, we constructed a term, but this term was only in order to allow the unify, the runtime function, to traverse it, and after the traversal, it was thrown away. Yeah, so that means we produce garbage. And that is kind of, one might wonder, is that really, is this required, that we kind of produce nodes only to destroy them, to throw them away in a minute? And that we kind of want to avoid. And therefore we might wonder, is this the ultimate art of compiling, when we just do this simple way, or is there a smarter way? And there is a smarter way, only that we have to think a little bit more. And this to motivate that, so what is the art of compiling? The art is to exploit all information which you have, statically have, to produce better code. So this means here, we have the T. So why do we have to construct the nodes of T? Instead, we could traverse the X, which is perhaps unknown, which is the runtime value. We traverse the X, and compare it with the T which we know. So we die without. We do not need. We do not have to materialize the nodes in T, if we just want to check the nodes of X. So instead of materializing T, we directly construct instructions which check the nodes of X. So that's the goal. And this is kind of you. This is the essence of compiling. You exploit as much all the information which you can extract out of your program in order to directly compute efficient code. And that we want to do. So that means the only thing what we do is we push, we do not push, we do not construct T, we only push the X, and then we do not construct the subterms of T, and only kind of have instructions which compare X with T. And so that's kind of that is the vision. So as always, so that is kind of the vision, and now I have given you the idea. Then there's a little complication. A little bit of complication because, for example, if X is an unbound variable, then this unification X equals T has to materialize the nodes of T. Why? Because T will become the binding of X. So there are situations where a subterm of T must be materialized, namely when the corresponding node in the X or whatever is bound X to is a unbound variable. Then we have to start materializing T or a subterm of T, but only then. And this is only in rare cases. So therefore, we kind of have to deal with two situations. Either we do not need to construct the nodes in T, only do the comparison, or to switch to this to the old style mode where we have to materialize T, but then we are sure that these nodes which we have materialized, these nodes of T which we have materialized, that they show up as bindings of variables. So that's kind of the idea. So that is we kind of now the code looks very simple again, as we you see that all my code schemes are extremely simple. So we kind of put the reference to the X, and then we do the code translate T to a code. This is this code U, and this code U actually will be not so completely trivial because it has to deal with these two situations. First, just comparing with the value on top of the stack with a node of T. That's the one thing for the checking, and for the other thing, this materialization. So let us, but this seems perhaps a non-so-trivial task, but we simply go, this code U kind of is defined recursively for the T. So we start with the simple cases and see what we can do. Yeah, and these simple cases are simple. Okay, so that's the point of simple cases. But they are the most important ones because often in simple Prolog programs you do not have constructed terms but only atoms and variables. And so if you can deal with this case already fast, then you have done 80% of your acceleration. Okay, so let us traverse the simple, consider the simple case if we have an atom. So this means on top of the stack we have a reference to something, and then we have to do this unification with an atom A. And if it's an unbound variable on top of the stack, we have to materialize the A, and otherwise we have just to compare. So this is a new activity which we don't know how to do, so therefore we invent a new instruction. So then there is this, in the same way, if the T is an unbound variable X, so then we know no matter what the value on top of the stack is, we can kind of establish a binding, and that a binding, and that would be this This is realized with this u-var rho of x. And this, if it's an unbound variable, if the t is an unbound variable, then we kind of, the unification always succeeds. And in some sense, it means, well, either if we bind something, a variable, and it's so far unbound variable to an unbound variable, or we bind this variable, which is anonymous, to the other one, so it doesn't matter. So we simply do nothing. So in that case, we simply pop. And then finally, we have this, if we have a already bound variable, and on top of the stack, we have something which is possibly and if the x is already an initialized variable, then we don't know what kind of value it is, and in that case we have to do unification of the binding of x together with the value on top of the stack. And this is, for that we need, we do not know how to deal with it, but one way to deal with it is to do a new instruction uref, which then ultimately will do this unify. So let us now see what this u atom and these things, we have now, you see, we have kind of produced a list of new instructions, virtually a new instruction for each of these cases, besides the unbound variable, this anonymous variable where we do nothing. So for the others, we have to provide the implementations now. So now comes the u atom. So the first thing is, when the u atom finds an unbound variable on top of the stack, then something must be done, namely an atom must be created and the binding must be installed. So here is the binding, which is realized, and we have to trail that the binding took place. That's it. Yeah. And if on top of the stack we found something which is not an unbound variable, but an atom, a reference to some other node, but to an atom A, then we kind of, nothing must be done, everything is fine, and we find something else, then we have to do backtracking. So this is that we find, this is the case where everything is fine. We compare the, on top of the stack we have a reference to an atom A, so then the test succeeds, and if we find something else, we have to backtrack. So that's for the u atom A, and you see that was not so difficult. For the u var, we have that on top of the stack we have a point. Sorry. We have a pointer to something, and here the u var kind of binds the. Puts this the same, copies the same reference into the, copies this reference down in the stack. What does that mean? That means if there on top of the stack we have a reference to an unbound variable, okay, then the ith local variable also will be exactly this unbound variable. So we do not kind of install one a new r value r thing here pointing to the same unbound variable. We simply copy, and if there is something which is already if there is a reference to a real value, then we put this if the address of a non-variable value on top of the stack, then we kind of just copy this address of a non-variable value down into the local variable, and that is initialized by that. Yeah? So that is what we do by this uvar. Okay, so now comes this pop thing. So that was easy. So this is popping, we know that. We just throw away the reference on top of the stack. And the uref I, so that is now the, this is the case where we have something on top of the stack and something in the, some value, and the ith variable has, the ith local variable has already some value. We don't know what kind of value. So this is the situation where we call the unify function for, we call it for the value on top of the stack and the value stored as in the local variable. And stored in the local variable, and we do the deref there. On top of the stack, we know for sure that it is already deref because we put it there. For the local variable, there could be several indirections there, so we have to do this deref there, and then we call the unify. And after that, this value on top of the single value on top of the stack has become obsolete, and we can pop it. Yeah, and please note in all these other three cases. So this is the only case where we call the this unify function. In all in these three cases, we can statically, or we can go without calling this runtime, this potentially expensive runtime function. Okay, this potentially expensive runtime function unify. So now comes the final case, and that is when the structure term a T with which we unify is not so trivial, is neither an atom nor a variable. So it is a constructed term. And now what do we do? So here is the constructed term. So we proceed. So the first thing, when we do unification, we at least in the runtime function unify starts at the roots, and so we do the same we do here. So therefore, this code U kind of compares the F with the reference on top of the stack, and then it proceeds to the subtrees. Yeah. So now here you see. So therefore, we generate a construction, an instruction U struct F comma N F slash N. So this is kind of the test whether the address on top of the stack points to an F. Now then there could be two things. Either we have on top of the stack an unbound variable, then we would have to do the binding and materialize the T. Yeah, if this is so we have to provide code for that, and this code is here, starts at here. So there is a block, therefore, for materialization of the full term T. And this materialization, this code for the materialization and for doing the bindings and such, this is here. This is starting at A. And now, this is here. This is the kind of, you can say, this is the building block. The building block for materializing the full term T. Now then, there's another, this is one case. The other case is when on top of the stack we found a reference to a struct F. So then unification at the root node succeeded, and unification has to proceed with the children. It has to process one child after the other. So now we have to realize somehow to implement the pre-order traversal over the term. Recall building up or the post-order traversal. Now we have to to implement a pre-order traversal. So that is, we have to go to the first son, then we have to do the son, then we have to proceed to the second son, and so on. And for that, we provide us with new instructions, navigation instructions, to arrive at the respective sons. So this is son 1 to son n. And then once we are done with the last son, we kind of do this up, kind of to proceed to the father. That is to skip, to pop the reference to to the current tree. So this is this up, and now this up that we execute when we are done with the unification for the full T, and it therefore contains an address where to continue. And so since in this case we did not kind of have to build up something, so we proceed after the building block. So therefore you see here there are two, once again, there are two parts of the code for the in the code U. One is the building code, this is the red one, and the other is the traversal and unification code, this is the green one. In the green one, so if we always stay in the green section, we never have to build up a term. And once we are kind of, but it could be that we hit an unbound variable, then we have to switch over to the building mode in the red. Okay, so that is, so what we see here, so now we have, so that is the overall structure. Once again, so the new things which we will then have to, we have to explain are these kind of instructions. We have to, and then there is some more, then there are two, now there, let us take another view at this building block. So that is, we arrive at B when we found an unbound variable on top of the stack. Then we jump to this label A. So the first thing what we do here is, before we can do bindings, we have to do the occur check. And the occur check must be implemented somehow, and it is implemented here. So this is a macro, consisting of several instructions, namely for certain variables occurring in the term T, for which we have to check something. And then comes the building code, so that we have this. We know how that looks like. And in the end, we have to do another instruction, which is to do the bind. The bind does the actual binding of the unbound variable on top of the stack with the constructed term T. So this is now. Let us so for the occur check. So the first thing which we have now to look at is how, what kind of things do we do to do the occur check. So the point is that let us go back one step. If this one here contains an uninitialized variable, so then that means that this variable has not yet encountered. And if it's not yet encountered, so then, okay, so then if it's not yet encountered, then it is different from the variable on top of the stack, which we check for occurrence. And it also contains no binding, so we have to do nothing with these. So the only variables which kind of are of interest, which could be equal to the variable on top of the stack, or could be bound to a term which contains the variable on the top of the stack, is if the T contains a bound variable. So these are the X bars. Yeah. So therefore, this one, this I bars, is the returns the set of already initialized variables of a term T prime. And that is kind of something which we can statically find out. Yeah, so these are those which we would have provided with a bar. And now if we have this list of variables with bindings, then this make row just produces one occur check for each of these variables. So these are a set of trees, and we kind of provide this checking for these trees. Yeah. So let us see now what this check I does. So the check I expects on top of the stack a reference to an unbound variable, and I is the index of a local which has already a binding. So that what we have to do. Okay, so we have to inspect this binding, this tree, for occurrence of this address, of this variable. So that is, we have to check, we have to call this runtime function, check, this runtime function check, with two arguments. The first one is the variable, this is S of SP. The second one is a term, and that is the deref of the local variable with relative address I. Okay? And if check is true, then this means everything is fine. So if it is not true, that if it returns false, then we know occur check failed, we have to backtrack. So therefore, if this is not the case, then we backtrack. Okay? And that's all. This is this checking thing. Okay. So now let us go back. So that we do this kind of operation, we therefore perform for all the initialized variables inside T. This is a sequence of such check instructions. And now then we build, if there was no backtracking, then we continue with the code A, the building of the term T. Then we have on top of the stack the reference to an R object, to the address of an unbound variable. And after the building, we have then here the address of the representation of T in the heap. And now, that is the situation. And now we have, what then do we expect from the bind? From the bind, we expect that this reference is redirected to the T, and these two things then are popped from the stack. That's the bind, and here it is. So on top of the stack, once again, you see now a much smarter and much nicer picture. We find the T which we have built up. Below that was the unbound variable which we now have to bind. And so we bind it. So that is inside here, the reference is, this is set to that. And then these two things on top of the stack are popped. Because, again, unification does not return a value, but operates by means of side effects. And that is the side effect here, to bind the R to T. Okay, so that is now we have the building, and so that means we have understood unification, half of it. Now comes the checking part. This is with the sun 1, sun 2, and so on. So, and the up. So what do we have to do there? So that is kind of to implement the comparison of the T which we have in mind with the term representation we find in the heap by following the reference on top of the stack, the address on top of the stack. Yeah? So the first thing is, we now have to look at let me see. So the struct. So the first thing is we have to check to make the test. Well, we have to test whether we have an unbound variable on top of the stack. If so, we go to the A where the building takes place. If not, then if there's not an unbound variable on top of the stack, since the thing on top of the stack is maximally dereferenced, we now check whether this constructor f, n is there. If there's not a, if there's an atom or an constructor g, m for a different g or a different m, then we kind of fail and everything is we give up and backtrack. But if it is a constructor f of the f, n, then the root was the same and we have to proceed to the children. And once we are done with the children, we pop the stack and proceed. So here's again this the code. We are now looking at this portion because the rest we have already taken care of. And here is the fabulous address which we use when we find a when we find an unbound variable on top of the stack. And here is kind of where we continue when we are done with the unification of this term. Okay. So now let us see what this what we expect this u struct to do. If this u struct instruction finds on top of the stack a reference to the s, then it simply does nothing. Yeah, it simply does nothing. So in particular, it means that the reference to the s remains on top of the stack. Why does it? Do we keep it on top of the stack? The reason is, this is kind of we maintain this on this struct, the heap object for the f, n, provides us with the information about the successors, the children. If we popped that that reference, then we would no longer have an access to the children, which we have to inspect. As long as there are children to inspect, we have to keep it. So we keep it. So if we find an unbound reference on top of the stack, then we jump to A. So that was kind of going to the building block, and that's it. Yeah. And otherwise, if neither of these cases apply, then that means we have either a then unification will fail, then we go to backtrack. Okay, so that means when we do not go to the A and just proceed, then the reference to the S is to the F, N is still there. So then the next instruction after this U struct F, F slash N is the sun 1. So the sun 1 now kind of recursively deals with the first sun. So that is, what should that do? So the sun 1 should kind of push the reference to the first sun on top of the stack. So now the stack grows, the local stack grows. So the sun I in general takes the ith, takes the I successor and puts it on top of the stack. So it's like a get I for a vector which we had in the MAMA machine. So by that the stack grows. Okay, and now so in this sense is sun 1, sun 2 extremely easy. So we had nothing particular to do. So it seemed as if it were complicated, but you see, in fact, it's a very easy operation. Now the only thing which remains is what happens at the end. So we are done with all the children. What do we do then? So if we are done with all the children, we do no longer need the children have disappeared. The references to the children have disappeared. They have been consumed. So now the only thing what stays on top of the stack is the reference to the S, to the F, N, to the S element in the heap, which is no longer needed. Instead, we have to go to B. So we could, well, if there would be something what one could do, that one kind of pops the stack before the last child. Yeah, you could optimize it in such a way that you kind of sun n, so that this instruction here kind of already gives up the reference to the father because we will not need it anymore, and kind of replace the reference to the father with the reference to the last son. So that we could do. Then this up here only would be a jump B. Yeah, but this is such kind of minor optimization that I kind of ignored it. And that means we kind of, after having done the last son, then we have still the garbage, as a garbage, the reference to the father, which is no longer necessary, and therefore we can do this up by popping it and jumping to B. So that is kind of, this up B is the same as pop jump B. Yeah, so it's an easy thing. And we have to jump because after this traversal over the term T, we had the building block for the T. And so since we don't want to run into the building block, we can we jump across. So now you have seen the code scheme. Let us see in the example how the code looks like. So here, this is code. This is a term T. We recall that we had that code, that little term, several times already. So we have, for example, the code A for that we have already. Now let's see how the code U for it looks like. Okay, so let's see. So we start with a U struct, F3, and with the address A1. Starting at A1, I make it in red. Is the building the building block for the full tree T? And you see, I make inside the red. I may highlight. So there is the first this occur check. So then for the occur check, we only have to look at the initialized variables, which is the x inside this term. So we have to check only the x. And that is this check. Then comes this code A for this term. I don't explain that anymore. This is the code which we have already looked. It is this put ref, put var, and so on. And after that, we have the bind. So this is the building block for the full tree. Okay, so now we proceed with this traversal thing. And so then once we have compared the roots, then we proceed to the first son. And that means we now have to do the unification code for the G of X, Y. So that consists first of a U struct G, 2. G/2 with another building block A2 for the case that this subtree will be compared at runtime with an unbound variable. Then we have to go to another building block, and that other building block starts at A2. It is here. This is this other building block. And again, this other building block, we may take the time to look at it. So that, again, it contains one one initialized variable, the x. So we have to also do the check, and it ends with a bind. And it has this sub-block to build up g x, y, which is the same as the corresponding block here. So you see, there's a duplication of code. So this... there is this building, the code A for G of X, Y in two places, copied. I come back to that. Okay? So that is the second building block for the subtree. Now, this was this this U-struct G slash 2. Now, I again proceed to the first son. So this is this X. X is a bound variable. So therefore, the unification is just U-ref 1. Then we proceed to the second son of the G, which is the Y, and that is an unbound variable, an uninitialized variable, therefore a U var 2. Then we are done with the subtrees of G, therefore we go up. And so we go up to the B2, where B2 is the first instruction after this unification code for the G, for the subterm with root G. So then we go to the next son of F, so this is son 2, and there's an atom A, so therefore U atom A. Then there we are done with the second son of F, so we go to the third son, and then we do a U var 3 for the set, and then we go up again to B1, and B1 is the first address behind. Okay? So what you see is that the yellow part of the code is just linear in the T, because there's an instruction in this yellow area for every node in the tree T. The red parts is this building code, and there are duplications. So you see that the subtree, for the subtree G of X, Y, we had to duplicate this building code. And that means if there are a lot of constructor, a deep series of constructor nestings, F1 applied to F2, applied to F3, applied to F4, and so on, and then N, then you would have the inner subterms. For that, the building block would be copied and copied. So that would result in a quadratic blow up in the code size. But now that is the price we pay by kind of doing this switching, having these separate building blocks. But this price is, again, now comes these stupid practical considerations. People say in practice deep terms are rare. In German, one would say this is a Totschlagargument that you can always say. So this situation, which I am bad at, this is rare. Okay, so this is just a claim, and this is clearly a bold claim. It depends where these Prolog programs come from. So if these Prolog programs come from Prolog programmers, and Prolog programmers typically do not write these very deep terms. So this I may well believe. This is the same for functional programmers. They also could write very deep terms, but very deep terms mean very deep nesting, and that means very many brackets. And you can't keep track of very many brackets. So therefore, in typical code, you never have terms, constructor terms, deeper than 3, 4, and then you simply quit or kind of try to factor it in a different way. So in that sense, it is reasonable, but there's no reason to believe why code should always be constructed by programmers. There's a lot of code which could be produced by code generators. So there is some kind of, for some tools, produce, say, Prolog code of some, so you have kind of a pre-processor or pre-compiler which produces Prolog, and then Prolog is executed, or produces OCaml, and then OCaml is executed, or produces C, and C is particularly popular as intermediate language for some kind of code generator, target language for some code generator. And for these kind of beasts, you know nothing. They, because a machine is not bound to is very good at counting brackets, and therefore will have no problems to produce terms for you of size 20,000. But that would kill the compiler. So that one should be aware of. And yeah. But then on the other hand, yeah. And therefore, this is a kind of deficiency. There are techniques how to kind of join or share these common parts in the building, but these are make the runtime system more complicated, and therefore I would not do not consider it as worthwhile. And kind of, you may kind of try to think about it, but and find a way how to deal with it. Okay. Is there a question to unification? Okay, so then now let's proceed. So once again, as a recap, this unification was not completely trivial because we had kind of these two modes, two kinds of code which we had to produce for the same code. Namely, the building and the matching. So that is was a new feature which we did not have so far. But beyond that, it was not so difficult. And the reason why it was not so difficult is because we postponed the trailing and the backtracking, and that we will have to keep in mind. These are kind of the points where things will become then more complicated. Okay, so now let's proceed. Kind of, we are happy that we found this analogy between prolog terminology and imperative procedural notions. And so one of these things was that a clause was a definition of a procedure. So that means if you want to implement a clause, that would be our next task. Then we would follow the same intuition. So that means a clause corresponds to a function, a procedure definition. So what would we do for a procedure definition? This P is the name of the procedure. The X1 to XK are the formals. The G1, the sequence of goals, G1 to GN, is the body of the function. And it may have more locals. So there could be, in the head is X1 and X2, and among the goals could be further variables, which are just auxiliary variables, X3, X4, X5. So the first thing when we try to generate code for the body of a procedure is we allocate space in our stack frame for the locals. So that is the first thing what we do. Once we have done that, we simply proceed and kind of implement the body, evaluate the body. And then recall that the ingredients for evaluating the body, that we have already provided. Why? Because the body consists of goals, which are either unification goals, for which we just have provided the code, and or these are literals, which are considered as procedure calls, for which we also have provided already the code. Yeah? So that means, for all that, we know how to deal with it. For the locals, okay, so we have to additionally to provide this allocation of the space for the locals. And then there's one more thing. What would we do once we are done with the body of the procedure? So recall what we did in C. We then had simply a return. And that means give up the stack frame. And that we would here also. We would like to give up the stack frame. It turns out that it will not be so easy to give up the stack frame, but still that would be kind of our goal. Okay, so now that is for the end. This is kind of a preview. Let us now go to the beginning, and that means to this one where we allocate space for the locals. So then we first, in order to do so, and in order to translate the body, we must know what are the locals, what is our address scheme. Now, the addressing scheme was to use relative to address the locals relative to the frame pointer. And the first k locals are just just the formals. So the next locals are xk plus 1, xk plus 2, and so on. And now the question is, how much space do we require for each local? And well, each local is an address. It's represented by an address, namely to a heap address, and then the value, be it an unbound variable, be it a constructed term, is sitting in the heap. So therefore, each variable only consumes space 1. And therefore, we can use this very simple very simple construction of the address environment by assigning the ith variable the relative address I. And we do not even have to distinguish between local or global or otherwise variables, because every variable, as I explained to you last time, every variable of a clause is considered as clause local. There are no global variables. Okay, so in that sense, very easy. No tagging, just numbering the variables. And keeping in mind that the first k of these variables are formals. Okay, so that we have to do now, what would we do for the code for a clause? R. So if the clause has R variables, then we kind of... So we could use this alloc M, which we had for C, but for traditional reasons, they have a separate instruction here. So let us call it pushenv M, which does the same thing. So it allocates the space for the locals. Then comes the code for the goals, which we know, because it's either literals or unification, and we know how to deal with it. And then comes another instruction to give up the stack frame, and that is this popenv. And what does this popenv do? The popenv returns the control, because then all the goals have succeeded. So this the call has been successfully been evaluated. Therefore, it recalls FP and PC. So that is the minimum what we expect from the popenv. And also, it would, since now this intermediate calculation has been finished, it would like to blow off the current stack frame. But it will not always succeed. Why? Because it could be so that in G1 we tried one alternative. And if later on in the course of evaluation things fail, then it could be due to the wrong alternative chosen for proving goal G1. So therefore we have to return to G1 to do another alternative and then proceed from there. Yeah? So therefore we cannot yet pop off the stack frame, because parts inside the stack frame could still be, there are some alternatives open. So the backtracking might return. And whenever you may return to something, then you cannot pop it off. So it tries to pop off, but it may not succeed with that. And the only situation when you definitely can pop off the stack frame is when you are sure that inside the stack frame everything, that there is no other choice anymore, no choice open, so you will not return to the stack frame or to any content of it, and then you can pop off. And that we have to detect somehow. So therefore, this popenv seems like a simple instruction, but this causes a little bit of problem. We can generate code for it, clearly, but we must keep in mind it tries to pop the stack frame, but will not always succeed, and we have to insert some checks into it to detect that. So, but pushing the environment is simple. This means simply setting the stack pointer to frame pointer plus n. That's it. And, as usual, once we have these dummy instructions, even if we don't know how they are implemented, we can use them to generate code. So that means for this nice little for this nice little clause, how would the code look like? So this is how do we do? So we first count the number of variables. First one, second one, third one. Yeah, and then we realize that here, so I mark it in black, this X here is at that position is already initialized because it occurs as is a formal. Formals are always initialized. The Y is also initialized here. The X1 here at that place is not initialized because this is the first occurrence of the X1. And this is the second occurrence of the X1, so therefore it is initialized. Okay? So this is the information which we have and that we can now use for code generation. So the first thing is we said three locals, so therefore push and three. Now comes the code for the first literal, for the first goal, which is a literal. So we mark a stack frame. So we put, we construct the terms for the arguments. So the X is an initialized one, therefore put ref 1. The X1 is uninitialized, so therefore put var 3. And then we have to call the F slash 2. So that's the first literal. Now comes the second literal. So this, so again we mark the stack frame. We X1 is initialized, therefore put ref 3. Y is initialized, therefore put ref 2. And then we call the second predicate as well. Now we are done with the body, and then we just pop off. Then we pop, and here we pushed. We pop env. We make pop env, and that's it. And so you see the code is very simple. So very clear and no complicated things. Also, complexity is hidden in here. Okay, so that was on this easy side. Now let's go for predicates. So predicates are a little bit more complicated now because a predicate, we said, is a procedure, but a procedure with multiple procedural definitions. So we kind of have to... So in this sense, you could think of as a procedure consisting of multiple implementations, and we kind of have we try the first one, and if it fails, we go for the next one, and so on. So we need kind of a handler there to deal with the alternatives. So, but in the, there's one simple case where we do not have to deal with that, and that is the case when the predicate is defined by a single clause. Oh, sorry. Did not want to cancel it out, but just to highlight it. So if the predicate is defined, so any predicate is defined by a series, by a sequence of clauses. If the sequence has length 1, then the code for the predicate should be the same as the code for this clause. So that's on the easy side. Now, if it's defined by several clauses, then we would do it as follows. We try the first alternative, and if that fails, we should be able to execute the next one, and so on. So that is kind of our implementation of backtracking. So now it there is no excuse anymore. We have to face the way how we deal with backtracking. And so the first thing is, okay, backtracking is initiated by calling the runtime function backtrack. So this is only the initialization of that, and then this kind of let us think what activities then have to be done. So clearly, the goal then is to roll back the computation to the latest goal, the dynamically latest goal where another clause can be chosen. Because we encountered a problem. Now, we did that by choosing x equals, by choosing the first alternative, which sets x to a. But there was another alternative where x was set to b, and that could be successful. So therefore, the last alternative, the dynamically last decision which we made, we would like to undo and then to redo with the next, restart there with the next alternative. So that is, we kind of have to keep track to the last point, dynamically last point in time, when we had tried to prove a literal in one way and there was an alternative. So that we keep in mind. And that is, how can we keep it? It is like for exception, this we have to point it to the exception handler. So now we need a point to this last to this backtrack. We call it backtrack point, to the last point where backtracking was, where another alternative is open. So this is the backtrack point. So for that we need kind of a handle. So this means we invest a new register pointing to that point so that we quickly can go to that. So this is the backtrack point. And then now in order to, we cannot only jump, we cannot directly jump there. We have kind of to undo all the things which we have done in between. So all the bindings between the current point in time and the point in time at the when choosing this alternative at the backtrack point, everything which we did there we must kind of undo. And that is kind of undone. So for that we have kept track of all the bindings by means of a function trail. I did not say what the trail does, but the trailing does, but at least this function was meant to do this bookkeeping. And now we use this the log, so to speak, of our bindings to kind of do the unbinding. So what does the trail... So for the trailing, we need a data structure where we kind of record all these bindings which are under which we did. You have a question? And so where could we do it? Well, we simply provide a new data structure. This is the trail. And then if we have a data, this is a stack. And so we need a stack pointer. So this is the trail pointer. So the trail itself is just a stack here. This is this T thing. And the trail pointer points to the topmost memory cell in the trail. And furthermore, we have, I said, we need kind of a pointer which points to the last backtrack point. This is like the frame pointer, only that the frame is somewhere deep in the heap. In the stack. And that means that for a backtrack point, now we can kind of make explicit what kind of data we have to store in the stack frame, in the organizational cells of this of the backtrack point. So we had already mentioned that every stack frame contains this positive continuation address and the old frame pointer. So that we have... we need. Additionally, at that backtrack point, we need the trail pointer at that position. And the old backtrack point, the backtrack point before. So that we, if we give up that backtrack point, we need what was the yet before last point in time where an alternative was open. So these two informations we need for sure. And also, we have chosen one alternative. We need what next open alternative is there. This is this negative continuation address, which is here at the bottom. And then there's only now you see one more thing. There is a heap pointer, an old heap pointer, which we also store among the organizational cells. Why that? between the backtrack point and now. We have put a lot of elements into the heap, and all of them now are garbage. So this is kind of on the top of the heap. We have a block, a full block of things which we want to kick off. So therefore, that was why we kind of so carefully made precise how we maintain the heap. Because now when the backtracking is, we do not have to deallocate each element on the heap separately. We just pop off everything which is in the heap in one go. So that's the cute thing which makes backtracking rather efficient when we implement it as it is implemented in Prolog. So therefore, we also have the heap, the old heap pointer, which we stored inside the stack frame of the backtrack point. So I guess that is it for today, and we continue with the implementation of Prolog next week. Thank you.